You know, there's a term in life, Jeff Merrick, that you hear
Right.
once in a while.
All right.
And the term goes something like this. It's not that I hate you.
Oh.
It's that you've just got one of those faces. You know, frequently what you hear is a punchable face.
You know who
I
said
don't like
that?
this
Hang
person
on.
because he's got a punchable face.
Craig Simpson said that on Hockey Night in Canada. Was it 2 years ago in the playoffs? It was a Vancouver game. They did a tight one shot on Maxime Lapierre, and all Simmer could come out with is, "How do you not want to punch that face?" It's one of the most candid moments I've ever heard on Hockey
Oh
Night.
God, and that's just a great example, right? Like Lapierre is actually like a decent looking dude, and I think away from the ice is probably a real good dude, but boy, he's got that face. He's got this devilish
Drive
little
you nuts.
impish, like, oh, that's the guy my daughter brought home kind of face.
You know who he used to terrorize in the Quebec League, in the Quebec Junior League? He would hound him. Sidney Crosby. I remember they would put him out there against Sidney Crosby when Crosby played with Rimouski, and he would drive him insane. That was the
Yeah.
first that I thought, you know what? This guy's going to make a really annoying NHL hockey player win it. Because he's got the skills, right? Like a guy
Right.
like Max Lapierre, you know, he can move his feet, he can get around, score in a pinch, kind of a clutch guy every now and then. But you're right. He just has that face that's
Punchable
made for
face.
that style of play.
A face that is
Awesome.
punchable.
See,
Yes,
I
I
love
would
it. I love
say.
having that in the
Do you?
game. I love
Do you?
having that type of player in the game to drive you to distraction. I don't think people
Now,
hate it, but I love it.
the punchable face, though, can not only apply to individuals, but I believe, Jeff Merrick, it can also apply to entire teams. You mentioned Max Lapierre, he's no longer there, but overall, based on the evidence, I think the Vancouver Canucks have the most punchable face of any team in the National Hockey League. And I'm frankly at a loss as to why. Like, I understand that they've had pests over the years. I understand Kessler's still on the team and he is a pest. I understand that there are probably people that don't like the attitude of the organization, maybe the attitude of the media, maybe the success, maybe the lack of success. I don't know. The accolades that come to Vancouver without having earned them. I don't know what it is, but here's the facts, okay?
Okay.
They've now have blood rivalries with three teams over the last few years that they weren't division opponents with. Now, they are division opponents with the LA Kings now, but not previous, and there's always been heat there.
Yep.
But I think it's been accentuated with the Dustin Brown Luongo tete-a-tete earlier this season. And then last night we saw 100 and, you know, over 100 penalty minutes between the two teams. But they've got heat with Chicago, and they have heat with Boston, obviously, from the Cup final. I've never, is there another, there's not another team I can think of that has heat like that with opponents that are not geographic rivals. It's pretty amazing.
Yeah, all around the NHL. Me, for one, I wish there were more Vancouver Canucks in the NHL. Because I think you and I are on the same page about, you know, heels and baby faces.
Yeah.
That, you know, an entire NHL full of Steve Yzermans, although it is quality hockey, it's kind of a boring game. And it's kind of, you know, a boring affair. Score the goal, put your head down, skate to the bench, don't offend anybody. I kind of wish there were more Vancouvers. And I think it's a, I mean, I think you should kind of wear that as a badge if you're Vancouver. We have infuriated teams that are so geographically, I mean, we fly in the face of everything that you hear about rivalries. They have to be geographically specific. Like, you have to be within, you know, 50 miles of the team or 100 miles or 200 miles of the team in order to have that type of blood feud. Vancouver proves no, quite the opposite. You can be at the other end of another country and still be hated, and those embers will burn. Now, a lot of this happens. I mean, all this comes out of playoffs.
Sir,
obviously. What?
sir, can you please not use terms like embers will burn when discussing
Oh,
Vancouver?
yeah. Man, I'll tell you, in that.
None of your coded
I
language,
was
sir.
in that. I apologize. That wasn't planted. That wasn't planted deliberately. Have I ever mentioned to you that I've never seen so many crystal meth fights as I did that night in Vancouver? I think we've all seen crystal meth fights before, right? Like at least one. Like, honestly, me and Morrison are walking through the riot, getting back to the hotel in Vancouver after that. We're like, okay, dude, let's go for it, I guess. Took us an hour. It should have taken us 10 minutes. Took us an hour to get back. I saw more crystal meth fights that night. Like, you know, the ones where guys will throw punches from the cellar, hit the guy flush in the jaw, and he shakes it off. You're like, oh, boy, This is deep water. I'm getting the hell out of here. I saw more crystal meth fights in that than that's one of the big takeaways actually from the riot in Vancouver that I'll ever have. Certainly when the first car went off outside of the post office, that was a big one. Being grabbed by security to get off our stage and get in the CBC building, that was another one. The taste of tear gas, which I found out was only subdued by Bud Light Lime, as I found out at the NHL party afterwards. That was a big one. But one of the big takeaways for me, Wish, will always be the amount of crystal meth fights that I saw that night. It was remarkable. What's your big takeaway? I've never asked you about this. This is something we got on
from
this
the
topic.
Riot?
Yeah. What's your big takeaway from the riot? Oh, the other one was how in the middle of the riot when, you know, there's police everywhere and fights and beatings and stores getting broken into. I'm calling Claire back home. Right? Okay, I'm going to try to get to the hotel now. She's like, okay, I'm just going to sleep. I'll talk to you in the morning. I'm like, I'm walking into a riot and you're going to bed. You want me to call you when I get? No, I'm going to sleep on you. I wasn't on site.
Costanica was on site and he.
No, but you watched the whole thing.
He wrote a remarkable story about walking through the whole thing as it unfolded. Watching it unfold, my one remembrance of the riot night, besides the next morning when we had roughly 50 billion hits from the couple that was kissing in the middle of the street.
That was pretty cool.
Was the reporter for the I think I want to say it was CTV. I might be wrong on that. The reporter who was literally in the middle of the riot and just kind of going around and having all of these insane people carrying things that were on fire and trying to loot stores, kind of swirling around him. And it was, I remember just sitting there watching this thing and putting up blogs over the course of the evening and in the overnight and thinking to myself, this looks like it's Baghdad. Like, this is what you expect to see in Baghdad. A reporter for CNN walking through with an army helmet as chaos surrounds him. Like, this is Vancouver after a hockey game and it looked like Baghdad.
Dude, for the second time.
Yeah.
Right? Like, that wasn't new. That happened before. Rangers.
See, that plays into it too, I think. You know, but the hate was in place before the final against Boston. I mean, it was one of the reasons why people sort of gravitated to the Bruins in that series is because it was the blue collar team versus the team of entitlement, the Vancouver Canucks. Like as Joe Pack writes, like Toronto being in Canada, the good, it could be akin to picking on the smart kid in school. It's kind of like there's that whole thing. Adam Nowak writes in, as a Canucks fan, I get it with Burrows, Kessler, Bieksa. I don't get Sedin hate. Strong, consistent players who are charitable. I think there's a large contingent of people that think the Sedins are overrated. There's so many different points of attack to this Canucks team. I know everybody, all the Canucks fans think I hate Vancouver. I don't. I don't. I mean, like, it's obviously sometimes a situational thing. I'm not exactly an Alex Burrows fan. I've not been a fan of Luongo in the past, although I think that his reputation has been mended in a number of different ways. I'm not a huge Mike Gillis fan, for example. But, like, by no means do I hate the organization. By no means do I hate all the players on the team. I think, you know, I'm a Kessler guy or not a Kessler guy. I like Bieksa a lot too. Mm-hmm. But like when you take our question of the day basically is, what is it about Vancouver that evokes this hatred and heat from other teams and I guess from other fan bases? And I got to be honest, man, like there are so many different points of attack to this team as far as criticism, as far as what it is about them that pisses you off. I don't want this to turn into a circle jerk of hate. I genuinely would like to know what it is about this team that pisses people off.
First of all, I just wish there were more teams like the Vancouver Canucks because this is a wonderful thing, I think, for professional hockey at the NHL level. Like, I wish there was a Vancouver Canucks East. I really do. I wish there was one of those types of teams that invoke that type of rage.
It should be Boston. It should be Boston.
Why isn't it?
I don't know. I don't know what it is.
Because I'm with
about
you.
It should be the
Boston Bruins, whether it's Brad Marchand, Tim Thomas certainly evokes a certain amount of rage from certain quarters, but he's no longer there. It really should be. But
Lucic.
But couldn't you make the argument, and I know everyone's going, well, look what Sean Thornton did to Brooks Orpik, but they kind of play it like old school fair and tough, right? Whether it's Chara. Whether it's one of my favorites in Adam McQuaid, whether it's, you know, Lucic, even, you know, I mean, that entire Merlot fourth line, that really does have that blue collar aesthetic, without the, and you know, this has been brought up before on this podcast, without the martyr complex.
Yeah.
I think in a lot of ways that's a big one. And
there's two things that you just said there that are so true. There is no martyr complex for the Boston Bruins at all. And I think that's one of the things people dislike about Vancouver. Not only the woe is me-ism from that team sometimes, but from the media out there as well. And when you look at the Boston media, there's only one guy that fits that bill, and it's Joe Haggerty. There's only one guy in Boston who does the woe is me, why don't we get respect thing, and it's Joe. And we love Joe, but that's what he does. But at no point does the Boston media in its entirety put forth things like the NHL is conspiring against us, Vancouver media is known to do.
I know.
Exactly. So I think there's part of that, but you make a really good point on that old school blue collar aesthetic that Boston has versus what Vancouver doesn't have. And here's the interesting point about that. I agree with you that the nobility of their old school mentality in many ways offsets Marchand, offsets Lucic, offsets the things that Chara does. Essentially, he took heat for the Patchy Ready thing.
Not for me.
Well, not from you, but from other people for sure. And
in
not
Montreal,
sure
yeah.
Who called the cops. No, yeah. I mean, there was people around the league that says that Chara is a cheap player sometimes, where he gets away with things sometimes just because he's Chara. For sure, without question. Point is this. In all three of those cases, those are players that at the end of the day you respect. Like, as much as you want to say Marchand's a rat, you have to respect his game. As much as you want to say Lucic can be a thug, you have to respect his game. Chara is the same way. I think there's enough old schoolness and honorability on that rock. Even Sean Thornton, right? Even a guy like him who pops off and does something dumbassy like attacking Orpik, at the end of the day, you know what kind of player he is. You know what kind of guy he is. I mean, it was a terrible, terrible lapse in judgment. But I think he's earned the right to be a guy that is balanced out by that blue-collar aesthetic. Now, here's where it gets interesting for Vancouver. For years, they've not had that. For years, even their guys that you could look at and be like, that's an ice warrior, that's a hockey player, a guy like Kessler. As much as you want to think about that playoff run he had where he was the best player in hockey for a couple of weeks, you're always going to think about tumbleweeds. You're always going to think about testing. You're always going to think about that. But the longer John Tortorella is the coach in Vancouver, I wonder if the scale gets balanced. I wonder if the blue-collar, hockey honorability, grit, taking pucks to the face kind of shit that comes with a John Tortorella team balances out some of the things that people hate about Vancouver.
I don't know. That's a long time. I mean, that's a long time in the making, sort of where Vancouver is at in their minds right now and where they're at vis-a-vis the rest of the NHL. And let me, quick little history lesson here. The Vancouver Canucks should have been part of 1967 expansion. The reason floated out that they didn't make it was, from the NHL, it's a bunch of, it's a famous quote, and it burns in the craw of Vancouver Canucks hockey fans, it's a bunch of 10%ers. It wasn't one guy who was buying the team or two guys that were buying the team. It was, you know, 10 guys that threw in 10% of the money. And the NHL, like, this is the smokescreen they threw up. They didn't want to have that type of business arrangement in the NHL for the franchise. So they got denied in the first round of expansion in 1967. 1970, of course, they lose what many in Vancouver thinks was rigged lottery, rigged Ferris wheel, and they got Dale Talon instead of Gilbert Perreault. The real reason they didn't get it in 1967, the real reason they didn't get in is because of television. And Toronto and Montreal did not want to split revenue or divide up any revenue from Hockey Night in Canada. That's why they didn't get in. So there has always been this sort of persecution complex, and I'll give it to them early. Absolutely. Like, they should have been a 1967 expansion. They should have been there. You know, they should have had a team in that next six or maybe next seven that came along for the NHL. Didn't get the franchise until 1970. And if you look at the statue, I've made this point countless times. Look at the statue outside of Rogers Arena. It is a martyred coach. It is the coach in that Chicago series, Roger Nilsson waving the white towel. We're getting screwed by the refs. That is the statue. And I love Roger Nilsson, right? We all love Roger Nilsson. But that's the statue outside the martyr complex, that one?
You love that, don't you?
But don't you think it's true? That. Like, you walk by that. It's not just a symbol, like, oh, look, that's Roger. Yeah, that's the symbol for your franchise?
And again, it's amazing how Boston gets off in these situations, because the statue outside their arena is what? A guy taking a dive. Yeah, a guy taking a dive.
By the way, that's been overblown too. He scored the goal before before he got tripped as well, right? By Noel Picard. Everyone thinks, he dove through the air and scored the goal. No, Sanderson gave it to him. He tucked it in the net, and then Picard tripped him. That goal has been, history has been very kind to that
you
goal.
Are
it's a pretty simple goal.
You are such a Bobby Orr denier. It's amazing.
I'm not
like,
a Bobby Orr denier.
The greatest goal ever scored isn't a big deal. Bobby Orr, if he was a unicorn because he played in an era where there was nobody else like Bobby Orr. You are such a denier.
No, it wasn't a diving through the air goal. He scored a goal, and then he got tripped.
By the way, I didn't mention this to you, by the way. So this is the Varsity Letters reading that we did last week.
Oh, yeah?
The Bobby Orr best player of all time thing came up, obviously, because Jay Greenberg wrote the Mark Howe book, and we talked about Gordy a lot.
Yeah.
But we talked about top player of all time. Who's your guy? And I was very happy to know that Joe D'Alessio from Sports on Earth, who was on the panel with us, agrees with me that the Mario Lemieux... Yeah. thing is a thing that I am not on an island about. He agreed with me.
Yeah,
I think that Jay said Gretzky because you can't deny the records. So it's Gretzky and two Marios up there, but nobody said Bobby Orr. Just to warm the cockles of your heart. Yeah.
To me, it depends on the time of day you ask me, and there's no ultimate number one. And you know what? It's what time is it? 17 minutes after 2 Eastern right now, and I can warm to the idea of Mario Lemieux being the number one player.
Hold on. Let's say that you have a belly full of Brussels sprouts, kale, and hummus. It's like 1:30 in the morning. You've had a couple pops in you, and you're sitting on the toilet. Who's the best player in the world?
Mario. But if I've just had a workout, I've gone for a long run, and my vision is clear, Bobby.
Yeah, there you go. Karen Douglas, I hate the Canucks even though I like some of their players. Management is both complaining and smug. Dan Gray, diving and Rafi Torres. Hawks hate has died down since Torres got traded. Canucks East is Philly. Canucks East used to be Philly. I don't think that they're there anymore either. And you know what? I think Boston, Philly, and the Penguins are probably the three teams. Oh, and let me throw the Capitals in there too. I think the Capitals have a large amount of hate. But again, it's one of those situations where I feel like it's waned in the years since they've gotten kicked in their teeth in the playoffs. They no longer have that sense of entitlement.
But here's
that they
the key.
Used to have.
Here's the key to Vancouver. A lot of the hatred that burns around the NHL built up over the last 5 years is because they've been effing awesome.
Yeah,
like,
for sure.
If that's a team that's like 15th in the conference, you're not building up that kind of hate. It's just like an annoying little bug. But these guys can annoy you and then beat you. That is what makes the burn. That's what makes the fuse long.
Yeah, and there's a certain plan in the parade kind of mentality, I think, on that team. Not necessarily amongst the fans and the media. I think they're very jaded and understand that it's very difficult to win the cup. But sometimes there's a swagger for that team that maybe is not necessarily earned. And I'm sure that gets under people's skins. Let's see here. Alex Sanyo, teams hate the Canucks because they're Canada's little brother. It never wanted in the NHL.
They didn't want him in 67. Blame Toronto and Montreal on that one.
Oh, Jesus. And we have Murph up there.
He's coming up Maddie? In a couple of seconds. Maddie's going to give him a buzz now. Right?
Okay, sounds
He's
good.
Give him a buzz now.
A couple more here. Let's see here. BRB, hockey's on. What is it about the Canucks that brings out nasty teams? Oh boy, this is going to be a doozy. Again, we're not trying to pile on. It's
a legitimate thing in the NHL, and you have to ask a normal question, which is why?
Nux. Oh boy. Oakenwood. Let's just go with that. Big fan of the Canucks, but in recent history, outspoken, arrogant GM. Arrogant GM, mouthpieces in 17 and 14, and Sedinery makes D look silly. The Sedins are a tricky one. Like, I feel like there are people that just generally don't like the Sedins for some reason. And I've never gotten that. I mean, Milbury is one of those guys, right?
Yeah, well, he just wants them to be something that they're not. He wants a cow to make ham. Sorry, that's not the way the Sedin, that's not the type of hockey players they are.
Right.
And if you're a good organization, you build around that, and you protect guys' weaknesses, and you big up their strengths. You put them in situations where they can be successful.
This is exactly why I wanted to do this question today. Jason Butler, having Henrik do one 22-second shift to keep his Iron Man streak going last year was embarrassing.
Yeah,
Everybody's got something. I know. Everybody's got their own thing as to why they hate this team. It's remarkable. It really, it's like a Rorschach painting. Everybody sees a different thing. I see Sedin doing that shift to keep his streak alive. I see Tortorella, all this other stuff. It's amazing.
Guess what we don't have today?
What?
An intro. Because guess what?
Yeah, I know.
All right, get to him.
Joining us, we'll get it after he leaves. Joining us down the line from Sportsnet, a man who's going to tell us why he hates Vancouver, because I'm sure he does, in his heart of hearts. Dan Murphy joins us.
Hey, Murph, we're just, last night, another, Donnybrook with the Los Angeles Kings. I mean, there are a lot of lit embers around the NHL for the Vancouver Canucks. The question we're asking today, Murph, is why? Where does all the hatred come from around the league with the Vancouver Canucks? You have a theory on that?
Well, I mean, I think personnel is one thing, and I think that not too long ago they were a pretty good team, and usually other people hate the good teams, not the bad teams. And so when they had Lapierre and Burrows and Kessler, I mean, those were three easy guys to dislike and hate. And when they were winning games with those guys, it made it even easier. So I think that's probably where it all stemmed from. Recently, I don't think as many teams have hated them because they haven't been winning, but they still have a couple of the characters that really get under the skin of other players.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. I mean, the one thing we didn't really talk about much is style of play. We talked about the pesting and things of that nature, but is there something to be said about the style of play that Vancouver plays? Because although the Sedins get knocked for their relative softness in the eyes of some, it can be a pretty truculent little team, as we saw last night with the well over 100 penalty minutes between the Kings and the Canucks.
Well, that's kind of a new thing, because when Vigneault was here, with Vancouver, they kind of went into let's turn the other cheek and kill them with the power play. Well, they certainly can't do that now with one of the bottom five power plays in the league. And Tortorella doesn't want them to turn the other cheek. He wants them to go after guys. He wants them to take back the ice, as he said. And he didn't have a problem with killing the first 10 minutes of the game being shorthanded. And that's not a real good recipe for success. But I think that they're kind of taking a little more the character of the coach presently, because they really tried to get away from that under the last regime.
Now, sticking with the power play as well, I know, Murph, in the last couple of years it has been underwhelming, and this year it's still nothing to write home about. But don't you see it different this year in that, unlike the last couple of seasons, not to get all analytics on you, but at least they're generating chances this time. Like this year, you see an improvement just by the fact that they're getting shots and generating chances. We haven't seen that in the last couple of years.
Yeah, and I think, again, it's slightly different. They're really teeing up the points with Garrison this year. They didn't use him at all last year. Yan Weber's getting a little time with that as well. And they've moved Kessler back to the spot where he should be, and that's either left point or on the left half wall and setting him up for the one-timer, because as far as the forwards go on the first unit, he's the only guy that has any sort of a shot, because Daniel and Henrik don't. I've also got another theory on why the power play hasn't been as good.
All right.
I don't know why the Twins can be so creative and so effective 5-on-5 where when they've got the power play they aren't. I think it's because guys don't chase them. They're in a box, they stand their ground, and they don't move around going after the Twins opening up the space. So they're going to have a lot more movement if they're going to score some goals. And, a power play goal at the end of last night would have at least given them a point, and they had that one with, 4 minutes left, and didn't really even get a good chance.
Do you have a theory on them in shootouts?
Oh, my God. Well, I mean, the Twins aren't very good one-on-one skill players. That's one thing. Kessler should be okay. Burrows is decent. Santarelli's decent. But after that, what do you have? I mean, they don't have a lot of those young, kind of skill-fast guys that seem to really excel in the shootout. Mason Raymond was one guy that you could kind of go to when they used to have him. But after that, they just don't have those type of players. And, and last year, they weren't getting many saves in the shootout either, and that's a pretty good recipe for disaster.
Oh, but oh, man, they'd kill it in 3-on-3.
Yeah,
oh, my God, they'd murder it in 3-on-3.
Yeah.
It'd be the best. Hey, about the Sedins, I saw my friend Jason Brough from NBC, who used to do the Curtain blog up there, lamenting the idea last night after the LA Kings game that the Sedins are now in decline, that they've lost a step, they're not the same players, and that has to be a very disturbing notion for a team that just recently signed them to two mega contracts. Do you see that from these guys, or is it simply a function of maybe not having the right help right now on this roster?
Well, I think there's a little bit of both. There's no doubt they're a little bit in the decline. They're 34. I will say one thing, though. With the Twins losing a step, I mean, they never had the step to begin with. So their game should, it really should, as they get older, it shouldn't affect it that much. Mm-hmm. But recently, I mean, their line mate has been, and I'll go through them since Burrows has been injured for most of the year, they've used Zach Dalpe, David Booth, Yannick Hansen. I mean, these are the guys that are rolling through the first line because they keep wanting to use Kessler and Higgins together. Santarelli's been up there. I mean, these are fourth and third line guys that are playing with Daniel and Henrik Sedin right now. And, you know, I know that Burrows doesn't have a goal in the games he's played, but he did have, what, 50-some shots. I think when he comes back, that will give them a spark. And I'm not saying he doesn't have to score, but he's going to give them a little bit more of a spark to kind of get their game back on track because they haven't had that consistent line mate this year. And the guys they have been playing with, aside from Kessler at the beginning of the season, just haven't been that good.
You know, curious wow. as well, and this is, as we've seen in the division that Vancouver resides, it's a murderer's row. It's deep territory for Vancouver this season. Come trade deadline time, what does this team do? And if they do look to make a move to bring someone in or a couple of pieces in to help them for the playoffs this year, Murph, let me know who's a sacred cow here. Gaunce, Horvat, Shinkarik. 1-2-3, 1-2, or all of the above?
I would say all of the above right now. I don't think they're willing in an old Burke term, mortgage the future. If they thought it was a deal where they could bring a player back and sign, or a player had term, then maybe they would do that. I mean, Gillis, the only real rental he's done was Derek Roy last year, and look how that turned out.
Yep.
I mean, Connaughton in a draft, it was brutal. But in 2011, it was Higgins and LaPierre. They re-signed both those guys. Right? Zach Cassian, I mean, he was a kid on entry-level deal. So usually at the deadline when he's been acquiring players, there are players that they intend on re-signing or have term left. So he hasn't really been a rental guy until last season, and that was an absolute disaster.
Now that we are in January, how have you seen the Tortorella system and the application of his coaching philosophy on this roster shake out?
I think, for the most part, guys are getting it. I do see a difference.
Hello?
You guys still there?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Sorry about that. Yeah.
Paul Hendricks there for some reason.
sorry about that.
So I think that they're starting to get it. They are far more aggressive on the forecheck. The defense are far more active, but it's gotten them in trouble. I mean, Dan Hamhuis is such a safe player, and he's a smart player. He's the one guy that's had troubles adapting. He's had a couple good months here, but you look at the winning goal last night. I think Bruce Dobigan called it being Hamhuis was being pinch drunk again. Just a bad time to pinch, missed it. They go 3-on-1, and they score. So there have been some growing pains with this, but overall I think they've adapted fairly well, and you really can see a difference in styles from Vigneault, who when they had the lead under Vigneault, they played kitty bar the door, and that was effective. Whereas this team, you know, although it's created chances, it's also cost them in games because they've blown a ton of late leads.
What have you seen in Eddie Lack? I mean, I've liked him going back to the Moose days as of you, but what do you see of him at the NHL level?
Well, I mean, he's a real super cool character. He's a funny guy. He's loose. I thought you saw being a number one goaltender with Luongo kind of taking its toll in those back-to-back games where they lost to L.A. and Anaheim just over a week ago when they gave up 49 shots in each game, and he looked like he was beat down after both those losses. I wasn't sure going into the season because he was injured all of last year, and his numbers with the Chicago Wolves the year before weren't that great. But from the goaltender guys you talk to, he tracks the puck very well. He's sound positionally. He's obviously a big guy, and he's very calm. So I think they've got a decent goaltender in this guy, and so far the numbers would back that up.
Last one for me, Murph, and thanks for joining us. Your take on the Pacific Division, and in particular, what you've seen out of the Anaheim Ducks and the San Jose Sharks this year?
Well, I mean, we haven't seen the Sharks since the first month because I think they played all four games
in
that first month. But the Ducks have really surprised me. I think everybody was waiting for them to fall off. Hasn't happened. The goaltending's been great. Their top-end skill was awesome, and the defense has held up. LA's had its way with Vancouver. You know, they've won all four games, although they've been tightly contested, and I think that's a somewhat more even matchup. And I don't know who I would say the class is. I'm just not willing to gamble on Anaheim yet. I still think that I like L.A. and San Jose once they get into the playoffs, but it has been just an unbelievably tough division. You know, a couple of years ago, 2011 might not have mattered too much to the Canucks because they were on that level. But now trying to slug it out and play these games, perhaps it's good to have Tortorella playing that pushback game because they're going to have to keep it ugly to compete with these teams, and that's something we wouldn't have said all that long ago.
I have a feeling, Murph, for my last question, your answer will be Kevin Bieksa, but I'll ask it anyway. Who's your favorite guy to talk to? I mean, you've been covering Vancouver for a long time. Who's your top go-to guy?
Yeah, I mean, he's the guy that will at least say things, you know, on the record.
Yeah.
He's been, you know, he's a lot of fun to deal with, and last night after the game, he pulled me aside, not on camera, and just said, you know, make it known that, you know, we have to respect Dustin Brown for fighting. You know, we were on him from the opening whistle to go with somebody to fight somebody. He played them like a fiddle in the first period, Cassian, and then Nolan did a Sestito, obviously. But he did go at the start of the second period, and you know, Bieksa said, you know, for him to do that, it showed us something. And you know what? You never know, something stupid might have happened, and you know, in the Thornton Orpik type of thing. So he's been a real good guy to deal with, and underrated too. The Twins, not always on camera, but always have funny stuff to say. And just one quick story: the penalty last night that Daniel took, that Henrik served,
yeah,
and Daniel ended up, you know, blocking a shot, killing his own penalty.
Yeah.
That's not the first time it's happened. It did happen in the Swedish Elite League. And one other mistaken identity thing Henrik told me was that in a game earlier in their careers in the National Hockey League, he got waved out of the faceoff circle, just did a little loop around Daniel, came back in and took the draw.
No. Come on. When was that?
It's early in their career, second year or third year. So you got one over on the referee that time.
That's awesome. Beautiful. Murph, always full of great stories and info. Thanks for dropping by, bud.
All right, guys. Take care.
Dan Murphy from Sportsnet Pacific, covering off the Vancouver Canucks.
Boy, that was a very, very jam-packed, notable game last night. A lot of shit happened in that game last night.
It's
Tom Sestito.
1 second.
27 penalty minutes in 1 second.
That's enough to make Randy Holt blush. That's all some of you old-time hockey fans.
Wow, there. Old-time hockey.
Yeah, thanks.
Yeah, what'd you think of Jordan Nolan in that situation, though?
I know. The old-school guy in me wanted him to go.
Yeah.
You know, but I understand why he didn't, guy. Got why he didn't, but...
Right, but essentially it's exactly what Murph just said about the Vigneault teams. I mean,
yeah,
that's turn the other cheek and get the power play. That's like old Canucks hockey flipped around on them because now they're the team that goes out and tries to send a message off the faceoff.
I don't
because
think...
John Tortorella teams have never done that before.
I know it wouldn't have ended well for Nolan had he engaged, but... Old school, code, you ran our guy, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Do the honors. Do the honors,
yeah.
I suppose.
Do the honors, you say, yeah. But that's interesting stuff from Murph, as always.
Well, and interesting about the Sedins, too. I mean, we've been waiting now for how long for them to be on the decline. An interesting point, too, about how them never being great sort of one-on-one hockey players. I mean, mm-hmm. I don't think you're going to have to look... You know, far and wide and deep into history to find two hockey players that work angles better as a pair in the history of the NHL than Henrik
right.
and Daniel Sedin.
Right.
And that's going to be when I look back at their careers in the NHL, that's going to be one thing that comes to me. Nobody worked angles with each other better than the Sedins. I've never seen a wish. It's almost as if they're living inside each other's brain and they find the most unique places to get each other the puck, and you just don't expect it. It's one of the freak phenomena, and the game slows down around them. And the funny thing is about it, the game slowed down around Mario Lemieux, and that's because people didn't want to challenge him one-on-one because he would embarrass you. Mm-hmm. You want to go one-on-one with Mario, good luck. And that's why everything slowed down when he had the puck, because nobody wanted to go one-on-one with him. Nobody wants to go one-on-one with the Sedins because they know it's not a move, it's going to be a pass.
Right.
It's going to be a pass that gets them out of trouble.
Right. Do you buy the idea that they need a good line mate to work with them, or are they good enough to make anybody good?
Well, they're not good enough to make anybody good. I mean, you look at the long list of right wingers that pair has had. I mean, they're always – Burrows has been the best, right?
Yeah.
Burrows has been the best of the bunch that stretches back for a number of years. I still think that in order to bring out the best of the Sedins, they need a good, strong right winger that can do a lot of the grunt work for them and distract away from them and open up space.
No love for Anson Carter?
Or Jason Krog. I mean, go right down the list. Right? There's so many guys. There's so many guys. But Carter did work there for a while. Anson Carter was really good with the Sedins there for a stretch.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Oh, I actually found a post on a site called the Internet Trash Can called Third Sedin's Past, Present, Future that includes Trent Klatt, Jason King.
Yeah. Oh, Jason
Anson
King,
Carter.
That was it. Yeah, Jason King. I know.
All right, joining us now on the line, one of our favorite writers, a guy who knows the Dallas Stars beat like the back of his hand, as well as most things in hockey. He is Mike Hajka of the Dallas Morning News, and he joins us again on the Merrick vs. Wyszynski podcast. Hello, Mike. How are you?
I'm standing on a precipice overlooking the fires of hell. Ooh. With a bunch of Stars fans here, and if they lose, the Edmonton Oilers tonight to run this to seven straight games, I think a bunch of them are throwing themselves in. That's how important Dallas versus Edmonton is tonight.
This sounds like a passage from Dante's Inferno. I'm curious now, Mike. This is very intriguing as a literary scholar myself. What's gone wrong? What's gone wrong with the Stars?
A little bit of everything. They went through a really nice win streak when they had some injuries and some illness. And I think some guys kind of emptied the tank. And then when the new guys came in, the chemistry wasn't as good, as ironic as it sounds. Having Cameron Gaunce or Kevin Connaughton out of the lineup actually hurt the team. And so they've been trying to get the chemistry back. And the last two games have actually looked pretty good, and they kind of blew it right at the end of each game. So they're hopeful that they're over the bad stuff and ready to win again, but it did some damage. I think they're, what, eight points out now, and it doesn't look good.
Yeah, 8 points out and back of Minnesota for the final wild card slot. I'm looking at a goal differential of minus 12. Has the offense run cold?
Yes. That's been a huge part of it. Sagan and Ben, Sagan hasn't scored in the last five games. I think Ben has one goal in the last five games, and that's hurt. And then, you know, it's the old thing. It's okay, so you get down and you start chasing the game, and, you know, you give up seven goals to the Islanders, I think, twice, five-1, seven the other time. So they basically, all of John Tavares' first star of the week for the NHL was earned against the Dallas Stars.
Bright spots, though, to focus on a positive. Bright spots you've seen this year from the Dallas Stars, whether it is Chiasson, whether it is Nichushkin, Brendan Dillon, who's sticking out for you this year in a positive way so far?
I'll give you the short, quick first bright spot, and that is Jim Neal. Even at a time like this, I believe most of the fans believe that Jim Neal is going to get this done the right way. You know, when you look at adding Sagan, adding Nichushkin, adding Peverly, those are some of the bright spots in the season. They basically came when the new GM came. And we're only 45 games into what I feel is, you know, a 2 or 3 year rebuild. So you got to give him time. But yes, individually, Sagan has been fantastic. I truly believe he's an 80-point guy, if not more. And he will be that way for, you know, what I think what the Stars hope is a decade or more. So you get a guy at 21 years old who's, you know, a legitimate number one 80-point center in the NHL, and he's in at a pretty reasonable price for the next 5 years, and I think that solves a lot of your problems. And it was a lot of what they were trying to search for when they were getting Mike Richards and Mike Ribeiro and Derek Roy, and, you know, they were grabbing for that one guy. Well, now they got that one guy. So that being in place is huge. And then Nichushkin, he's been in a slump lately, but he's 18 years old, and I think they see the potential there for an elite player, and add him to Ben, and now you've got three elite players, hopefully, and that's a pretty good base to build on.
This power play sucks. It's a 12.4%. It is 29th in the league right now. I look at the personnel on this team, and I say to myself, this power play should be better than 29th in the league right now. What's gone wrong?
Everything. No. They've actually, you know what's funny? Lindy's worked on it hard, and he's been pulling his hair out what he's got left. And they've actually had some nice power plays where they've created chances. But you're right. I mean, this is, the bottom line is they've got guys, they have elements that could, you know, put together a really nice power play. The biggest weakness is they don't have a booming shot from the point. Lindy's gone with only one defenseman, so you'll see Sagan or Peverly or Whitney up there a lot. I'm more of a fan of, you know, go find one guy, and, you know, even if it's Brendan Dillon and he hasn't played the power play much, if that's the guy who's got the hardest shot on your team, then put him out there. And then the other thing is they, you know, because they're not succeeding, they keep changing. And I wouldn't mind them going, you know, go find your five best power play players, throw them out there time after time after time. Mark Crawford used to do that with Brad Richards, and that group actually was pretty good back in the day. So I wouldn't mind seeing that, but they're scrambling. They're changing all the time because it's not working, and I think they need a little bit more consistency. But I don't think they're going to get that. You know, I think it's going to have to be the changes are going to have to produce the goals. And then once they find whatever change it is that produces a goal, they'll stick with that.
You mentioned Jim Nill a couple of seconds ago, Mike, and as trade deadline approaches, many would circle the name Eric Cole. But if Dallas is still as out of it as they are now, what does Nill do and who does he do it with?
I think the actually the number one guy who, and again, this isn't a big-time player, but I think it's a type of player that every playoff team would like is Vernon Fiddler.
Mm-hmm.
I don't believe he has a no. I think he does not have a no-trade clause, and he's an unrestricted free agent. So that will be the one that, you know, one, he'll be available for sure, and two, I think there'll be a demand for him. Cole has a no-trade clause. Whitney has a no-trade clause. Sean Horkoff has a no-trade clause. Sergei Gonchar has a no-trade clause. So those are people you're going to have to convince that, hey, you know, and especially in the case of Horkoff or Gonchar, you just moved here, you moved your family 6 months ago. Do you want to go do it again? So that's going to be interesting. The other thing I think that's interesting for Stars fans is this defense needs to be changed. I mean, it just does. They either need to add several good players and push these players down, or they need to move some of these players out and let some of the kids give a shot. And so depending on what people have available on, as far as cap space and how they could work a deal, I would not be surprised if conversation starts up about Alex Goligoski or Trevor Daly. I think they're both really good, you know, 30-year-old or 29-year-old defensemen. And they are just scaled up too high in this system. And if you can put them in a system where they're not scaled up as high, I think, you know, there'd be interest out there for both of them. And then the question would be, is that the way Jim Nill wants to go? Does he want to, you know, kind of gut this and tear it down and let some of the kids play and rebuild it from there? So that's the one I think the Stars fans are all interested in. They believe the defense has to change. And then the question is, how do you change it?
Let me follow up on the blue line here. What then becomes of, and boy, we love him, classic, quote-unquote, you know, stereotypical Warrior hockey player, block everything with his face, his knee, his ankle. What happens to Stéphane Robida?
It's a really good question, because one of the things you watch with Lindy when he's helping with Team Canada is he's big on a lefty-righty thing.
Yep.
And the Stars, currently assembled, have 7 left-handed defensemen. Their one right-handed defenseman is Stéphane Robida. He's been a hero. He's been a warrior. He's an unrestricted free agent. But if he comes back from this broken leg and he looks decent in the last month of the season or whatever, I kind of think they wouldn't mind keeping him. If he wants to stay, now he may look at his career and say, I'd really like a chance to go play for Stanley Cup contender. And then, you know, just move on. And that's his decision because he's a USA. But if you're just drawing this up and saying, hey, we might move Trevor Daly or Alex Goligoski, then I think having a Stéphane Robida around would be very helpful, especially the right-handed shot. So I think it's kind of up in the air right now. And of course, you know, they have to see how he feels after he recovers from the broken leg.
Boy, you guys just picking at the carcass, huh? Boy, oh boy. Vultures on the radio here. What was the bigger surprise for you, Heike? Was it Nikushkin making the Russian team or Jamie Benn making the Canadian team?
Nikushkin.
Yeah.
Sergei Gonchar had said that, you know, he's a veteran guy, so he's clearly a little bit in conversations, that he had heard some buzz about Nikushkin. But the kid is 18 years old. I mean, I like him. I think he's got a lot of talent, but he's also really inconsistent, and he looks like an 18-year-old. And, you know, to take him and then put him in the, you know, what I believe is the highest pressure tournament you can be in, I think that's asking a lot from him. So we'll see. I think Jamie Benn is exactly what Team Canada needs. He's a guy who can play down the lineup. He's a bigger body. He's a good enough skater that he can handle the big ice. And then if you need a key goal, he can give you a key goal. But he's a good defender. One of the things that's been really interesting with him this year is with Sagan and Peverly coming in as right-handed face-off guys, Ben has been able to reduce his face-off pretty much in half, and moving to the wing helps too. But he has gone from 47% to 59%. So he is a 59% face-off guy, mostly going on the left side. But that can be really helpful. I mean, if you're trying to put a line together, and you know, you can get a right-hander who wins on the left or right side and a lefty who wins on the left side, I think that can be really helpful in some big games down the stretch in the Olympics. So I like what Jamie Benn does. Now, again, he's going through a slump right now, but I think he's a good fit for Team Canada.
Mike, last one here, and we'll let you get on with your day. Curious about the turnstiles. How have they been?
Bad. And the kind of the good thing about bad is that they're reporting bad. I think it was 13,000 last game. I may have been 12 the game before. And I've had this discussion with a lot of people because there's always that feeling that they're Atlanta, right? I think there's people think, oh, they're going to move. They're going to move. They're not going to move.
Right.
I mean, Atlanta missed the playoffs, I think, 11 out of 12 years before they, you know, they got moved. So they're not going to move the Dallas Stars. So instead of trying to chase the turnstiles, at least this is my take on it, build a winning team. Build a winning team, and you'll fill the building up. And, you know, so instead of trying to chase a playoff berth this year, do whatever you have to do to make this a winning team for the long term. Mm-hmm. And I look back at Chicago, and we used to go up there, and the upper deck would be completely empty. And now you can't get a ticket there. Mm-hmm. And they built a winning team, and they went through, I think it was 2 years when they had Kane, Taves, Seabrook, and Keith, and still missed the playoffs. So it's a process, and that's a, you know, thing I'm trying to tell fans down here is, you know, just be patient. I know you've been patient. I know it's been terrible, you know, 5 years without the playoffs, but don't get impatient now when they're trying to do it the right way. You know, to them, they're only 45 games into this. I know you're 6 games into it, or 6 years into it, or 5 years into it. They're only 45 games into it, so let them do it the right way. And so I look at the turnstiles the same way. Build a winning team. Don't go chasing the playoffs. Don't worry about entertaining the masses. You know, they'll show up when the team wins. But, you know, if you're just going to be a team that's always chasing seventh or eighth place, then you're always going to have attendance issues.
It's great stuff, man. All right, Mike Hyka, thanks again for joining us here on the Merrick vs. Wyshynski podcast, and we'll speak to you soon, good sir.
Thanks, Mike.
Thanks, guys.
You know what? I hope Dallas is a good team sooner than later. You know why?
Why?
Because Colorado is becoming a really good team. It looks like they'll be a consistently good team for a long time. And how good was that Colorado-Dallas feud? How good were those games, Wish?
Yeah.
Don't you want that back? I want that back.
Well, like you said, Colorado's now in the upswing. And I think one of the reasons why is all of a sudden the top pick looks like the rookie of the year, doesn't
it? Holy smokes. Okay, what is it? It's as if I've been watching a lot of Colorado just lately. I mean, I watched the beginning of the season a lot, and then I sort of had a glance here and there. But lately, the last few weeks, I've been watching more Colorado games. When did Nathan MacKinnon turn awesome? Like, every time he's on the puck, he's strong. He's fast. I mean, he's burning guys to the outside and cutting to the middle. He's playing with the confidence of a guy who's a first overall pick who's got 5 years under his belt. When did he get awesome,
right?
Wish? There's a better question for Data to get Data on the show, but holy smokes, he's blowing everyone out of the field.
Eight goals and 9 points in a 9-game stretch, leads all rookies in points, power play goals and shots,
awesome.
And tied for first in goals with the MIA, Tomáš Hertl, who got Hertl.
The way he's playing now, it didn't matter if Hertl was still playing. By the end of it, he would have lapped him.
The other thing, too, about him is, and Huberto did this to a certain extent last year. Well, not to a certain extent. I mean, this is what he did last year. MacKinnon's doing it with a bunch of different line mates, too. It's not as if he hitched his wagon to a line that works, like Hertl did, for example.
Good point.
He's been up and down the lineup. He's been playing with different players. And a rookie's ability to do that, to post impressive numbers with different line mates at all times is ain't exactly a skill that's commonplace amongst young players, him and Huberto did that.
You're right. I mean, there have been some nights where I've watched him play, no offense to these players, with John Mitchell and Cody McLeod, and he's still getting it done. So he's not playing with, you know, Landeskog and O'Reilly and Stastny, who's having a really nice season, too. Good year to have one. I mean, he's doing it. You're right, up and down the lineup with not all top-notch centermen and wingers.
You know, something that Hyka said to me, said just before to us, kind of stuck with me because I've heard this voiced by players, and I wonder if you buy it or if fans buy it, which is the idea that even though there's a continuation of a franchise through the years, even though there is a legacy, there is history, essentially you have to hit the reset button every so often. And if you're a struggling team, it means that you change the core. You swap out the engine. You bring in new players. But there's always going to be that anchor around a team's neck if they've not been successful for years. Mm-hmm. And I forget what player said it. I want to say it was a Leaf. It might have been Lupul who said it. But the idea that players should not be weighed down by the history of losing, by the expectations of fans, that it really should be a situation where it's a new season with new they want to be basically American Horror Story. They want it to be it's some of the same faces, but they're in different roles, and it's a completely different story, so judge us on the merits of this new thing rather than the old things that came before us. And I don't know if that's a thing that fans can do. It's
fans,
almost like
fans
teams
wish fans can't do it, but players have to.
Listen,
if you're a Maple Leaf and you wake up every day and the first thing in your mind is Jim Pappin scoring the Stanley Cup winning goal in 1967, you can't get out of bed, let alone make it to the room. The weight of that will burn you. Oh, and then Chief scored the insurance goal. Oh, there's no way you'll even get to the arena. I think players honestly can't play with that albatross of the history. Fans carry that like an anvil around their neck, right? They carry that like a weight. And that's why that all that venom is heaped on players and teams and general managers and coaches and owners. I think good players let go of that. I think good players don't have it in the first place. Like, if you're John Tavares, are you thinking about, wow, man, it's been a while since Trotz and Bossy were around winning Stanley Cups? No. Or else you'd never make it to the rink if you carry that around with you. Fans do, players don't.
But that's what's interesting about that, though, because if you're John Tavares, it's inescapable to not think about that stuff. They're part of the organization. They're ambassadors. They have knights that honor the four cup teams. The
same
banners
as Maple
hang Sittler's over the
always
ice.
Around.
You are always reminded of it's like when you're a high school football player and it's homecoming and the team that won the state championship 10 years ago comes back and everybody's high-fiving and hugging them and showing off class rings. Mm-hmm. Like, it's impossible for you not to look at those guys and be like, "Well, shit, I wish we weren't 0-6." You know what I mean? Like, it's a weird historical thing where teams have to embrace the past. They have to acknowledge the past. They have to acknowledge legacy, be it successful or unsuccessful, yet at the same time have to divorce themselves from all of it. Even though you're wearing the same. That's
okay.
Why I think sometimes it's good for teams to change their jerseys. You know what I mean? Like, that's the ultimate closing the door in an era, is if you change your shit and you look different than the team that won did, well, then you're a new thing. Best example I can give of that, the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. The Tampa Bay Buccaneers for years were neon orange, and they sucked on toast. They were terrible. They were an embarrassment of a team. And then they changed to that sort of copper and red, and then all of a sudden the Tampa Bay Buccaneers can play football. The Tampa Bay Buccaneers are doing things. It's a whole big thing with them. And I felt like the uniform change. Devils were another example. Devils go to red and black after the Christmas tree jersey, and the red and black era is the era with three cups, five Stanley Cup final appearances, and what is tantamount to a dynasty. Sometimes you have to change the uniform, I think, to have that point of demarcation from the past.
What I like, I'm curious where you're at on this, because I'm pretty sure Edmonton did this. This was a Dallas Eakins initiative. Getting pictures of the past out of the dressing room. That's for the fans. That's for the concourse.
That's
for the arena. But in the room itself, if you're Edmonton, get rid of Gretzky. Get rid of Messier. You know, get rid of all that. You can't get rid of Kevin Lowe. He's hanging around the league. But, I mean, get rid of Grant Fuhrer, Glenn Anderson. Get rid of all of them. All those pictures.
Wasn't Leiwicki mocked for that? For swapping out all the old pictures?
Well, he wanted to take it. Like, I think the impression was he wanted to get rid of all those pictures around the arena, which I don't believe in that. I think that your rink is a sort of standing hall of fame for your team. And when you go in there, you should be able to celebrate different generations of your hockey team through photographs and
anecdotal. It's a temple.
Yeah.
You're going to pray at the temple for 3 hours is the way it works. Yeah, it's a really fascinated.
But the dressing room, get all the old stuff out. All of it.
Yeah.
All of it. That's your room, not their room.
Yeah, I've always been sort of fascinated with that idea that how does a team divorce itself from the past? And the other thing about it too, one of the times I really gave this a lot of thought was the Rick Nash trade, believe it or not, from the Blue Jackets. Because for years the thought was Rick Nash could come to Toronto and they would build an effing statue in his honor if he could go there and lead them to victory. Like, he is the local boy made good. He'd come back, he'd go to Toronto, he'd become a Leaf, he'd be the continuation of the Wendell Clark power forward aesthetic, except he can actually score a ton of goals too. Like, he'd be the guy. And it was always a situation where all he had to do was say yes. Like, all he had to do was say, yes, I'm going to go there, and a trade could be completed for Rick Nash, but he never wanted to go. And I know there's a lot of, like, friends and family and local pressures and all that headache that you get when you live and play at home versus when you're living and playing in New York City. But I always thought in the back of my mind, this guy doesn't want the trouble. This guy doesn't want that to be the thing he has to overcome, where he's got decades of losing on his shoulders, and he's seen as the guy who's going to end it. Like, that's got to be too much for any – you're right. It's too much for any player to handle, and I'm wondering if certain guys maybe avoid certain situations knowing that even if they want to go there and hit the reset button and say this is a whole new team and this is our bag, there's no divorcing the expectations of fans and the weight of legacy on a player when he arrives there.
It takes a really unique type of – not just player, but person – to be able to excel at hockey in a place like Toronto or Montreal, where the pressure is immense. I mean, you have to really embrace being in the spotlight, which is why, you know, the Phil Kessel phenomenon, I mean, he's one of the shyest guys in the NHL. To be honest with you, I'm kind of surprised he signed that mega extension with the Maple Leafs.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, a lot of playing for the Leafs is playing in Toronto. It's the reverse of what used to happen in Phoenix, where guys would say, I want to play in Phoenix, but no one said, I want to play for the Coyotes. Well, of course you want to play in Phoenix. The scene is great. It's a great place to live and raise the family. If you're a golfer, you can go golf. But, I mean, the opposite of me. Here, if you're playing for the Leafs, you're living in Toronto. And being a Maple Leaf is a 24/7 job. It is a special type of person that can embrace that and be successful at it.
Right.
Sundin did it great. Gilmore, Clark, you mentioned. We're fantastic at it. It is really tough. And that's why I think a lot of the local boy come home stories, you know, don't end very well in Toronto. It is tough for a local boy to do well in Toronto. And I think that's why a lot scared him off, because you grew up with that weight. I mean, a lot, David Clarkson talks about all the time about, you know, growing up a Maple Leafs fan, loving Wendell Clark and all that kind of stuff. He's getting killed in Toronto right now. He's getting destroyed in Toronto right now because he's having a bad first year of his contract.
Well ahead of schedule, by the way, for that demolition. Well ahead of schedule. We all knew it was going to happen, but right.
He's getting crushed. And the local boy goes home story doesn't always work. I would even make the argument, you brought up Lupul. I mean, he's from Fort Saskatchewan, right? How did that work when he went to Edmonton? Right? Sheldon Surrey, another one. Like, the local boy goes home story doesn't always work. Most times, I would argue, it doesn't work as opposed to it is successful.
And then you get Jim Dowd from Brick, New Jersey, who won a cup. So there you go. a couple of things real quick. Matt Lickenstotler is Rick. I'm sorry, Matt.
Ooh,
Shut up. Matt's musings won on Twitter. When the Ducks drop Mighty from their name, they won a cup. Yep, change the uniform.
Yeah,
change
when the
name.
Ducks got Scott Niedermayer, Chris Pronger, they won a cup. I think that had more to do with it.
Shifted the whole paradigm. Right. Your puck luck increases.
I will
That's
come
happens.
To Anaheim, but I'm not wearing that thing on my crest.
That's what happened. Obviously, it was the uniform change. Changing the uniform works for most teams unless you're Buffalo, from swords to goat head to slugs to turd burgers. Very good point. Ooh. Doesn't work all the time.
Wow.
Sometimes it does. Real quick, a couple of the answers to the question today, because I know you got to get out of here, and I got to get out of here. And if anybody has a problem with it, F you. We were on the air for 2 hours yesterday.
Jesus wish.
QOD, Tom Ginsburg Jr. writes in, that's what happens when players run out of BC Bud.
It's funny, too. I mean, there's such great pod out there. Why are people so stressed out?
It's Jay angry. Barkman. Why we hate the Canucks, or why it seems like teams hate them, as I would argue it's a complex they and their media and fans have from the fact that their team is straddled between two team identities, skill and finesse and toughness. The Canucks
Boston's,
are a bunch Boston's, of schizophrenics when it comes
Boston
to identity.
Boston seems to pull that off quite well, though.
Chicago does, too, I think, although they're not as Boston-y. Yeah,
Anaheim.
Uh-huh. Yep. John Lee, one of the easiest reasons it is so easy hate on the Knucks is their whiny ass sense of entitlement and generally kind of douchey fan base. Canucks fans are not douchey. They're like every other fan base. They make excuses for their team. And frankly, I hired a Canucks fan to be on the Puck Daddy staff, so they can't all be that bad, right?
H. Mooney.
That's right.
Who I've never forgiven. Doesn't exist to me. For lumping me out of Call the Union.
And then finally, Hunter Crowther, why teams hate the Canucks. Whenever I think back to any recent Canucks playoff series, the memories of Brad Marchand and Milan Lucic or Mike Richards and Jarrett Stoll or Duncan Keith getting under the skin of the core of Vancouver's lineup has been one of the lasting images in my hockey history. In the society of the National Hockey League, players like the Sedin twins, Ryan Kessler, and Alex Burrows are universally hated by opposing teams for the way they carry themselves on and off the ice. In many hockey circles, Bieksa is looked down upon for what is perceived to be his fake tough guy act.
I don't know about that. No, he's not a fake tough guy.
But I really do believe the Canucks franchise recognized this and wanted to wipe away the soft connotation that follows them by firing Alain Vigneault and hiring John Tortorella. Teams love playing Vancouver because it allows them to exercise the hate and bully attitude that pro athletes are afforded in their field. Now with the addition of Tortorella, the team is responding in a way that we didn't see a few years ago. Whether or not that produces postseason success is yet to be seen. A very good point. Like Murph mentioned, they're knuckling up in a way that they've not. And we'll see what happens to that end if they change reputation. Again, I entered this with an open mind. I don't hate Vancouver. Do you hate Vancouver, Merrick?
No, I told you. I wish there were more Vancouvers in the NHL. I wish there were more teams like that that elicited that type of emotion from visiting fan bases and teams. It would be a much more interesting league.
But I'll say
that's kind of the way it was in the 80s.
I'll say this about
Vancouver. You and I grew up watching hockey. Like, I mean, how many teams were like that? Tons. Tons of teams like that. It wasn't just the Smythe. It wasn't just the Adams division. There were tons of teams that were like that all over the NHL.
I'll say this about my Vancouver hate, okay? It's not hate. It is, as we mentioned at the top of the show, punchable face syndrome. They are a target that has a number of different entry points on which to ridicule and mock them. They are a team that, for whatever reason, you relish their failures versus celebrate their successes. And there are other teams like that, too. They're not alone in that. I don't know what it is, but there is palpable hate for the Vancouver Canucks, and I don't know. Maybe the Tortorella thing does balance the scales, like I said, where we go from being a team of the, let's say, less reputable reputations of some of these players to a team that does adopt some of the blue-collar aesthetic and hero worship that we see in Boston, but what remains to be seen. I'll tell you one thing, man. Like, a guy like Mike Santarelli helps move the needle.
Yeah,
you know?
Mike Santarelli.
You know, there are guys in that roster that definitely move the needle a little bit towards the happy medium that the Boston Bruins have seemed to found between deplorable behavior and blue collar working class hero stuff. So we'll see. It's a good discussion. I feel bad for people who saw the title of the podcast today and assumed it was just going to be us pulling down our pants and shitting all over Vancouver, because that's not what we were going to do and that's not what we're about. So. Hopefully, we've all learned a thing or two today.
We can talk about the Rangers and you can have at it.
Oh, God. Just don't let your children anywhere near them. A bunch of lollipop givers in vans. Oh, terrible.
Who was that, Maddie?
What was that?
Drops in the show now?
I know, right?
I did. I played some Dave Chappelle there.
Oh, jeez.
But I had to really be careful what part
of it. Do you have the Tim and Sid horns?
Now we're getting gimmicky. Oh, no.
No, I don't have the horns.
No. Please, no. No radio elements.
I'm just going to use the hat from now on, what you just did.
No drops, please. Yeah. I'm against all elements. I don't even like doing an intro. I just want to start talking and then stop. Yeah. Oh, man. By the way, Wish, you and me totally messed Maddie up. He had to tighten a knot yesterday. We went on for an extra 30 minutes. Dude had to whiz the whole time.
Toronto Raptors.
I had to get one of the interns to open his mouth. It was terrible.
Maddie, Toronto
Blue Jays. UFC. Chris Bosch, the Bosher. LeBron. There, now you don't have to listen to Tim and Sid today.
Hashtag,
we cover the show for you.
Hashtag Grody.
Hashtag Tim and Sid. All right, everybody.
And what do we do? little podcast. We make jokes. Because we've arrived. Because we put the flag in the moon, right? You and me.
Damn right. Okay. Sure. Let's have American Wish on to talk hockey.
Yeah. Is this like old podcast versus new podcast feud?
I just realized that my Tim voice is very much my McCowan voice.
It's very much your Barry White voice, I've noticed as well.
Yeah, it's the same thing all over the place.
Walrus of Love voice.
I have it on good authority that Sidney Crosby is going to have both of his legs amputated.
And replaced with
robot legs. Like the Ed 209 from RoboCop. Thanks, Bobcat. Thanks for the scoop. Got that from his nephew. Okay, thanks.
I would love to carry this on and see how long it'll take Maddie to have a squirt and watch him explode. But I got to
go.
I got to do pre-tapes. I got to get
there. All right, everybody. Thanks for joining us. I'm Greg Wyshynski of Yahoo Sports.
Merrick here doing a couple of games. Got the Ottawa game. Yes, they're in action. The Calgary Flames as well against the Nashville Predators. Pre-game. What am I doing pre-game? 7:30 Eastern. There you go. Two games tonight.
And if I may, I will grab the microphone. Finally.
Oh, no.
Greg Wyshynski has come back to Verizon Center. Capitals Sharks tonight at the VC in DC.
Where are you going to be after?
Which means, ladies and gentlemen, after all the reporting's done and the stories have been written, it is time to go back to the channel. The Irish Channel will be the place if you are in the area roughly an hour and a half after the game. Come over and have a pint.
Bring money because someone's got to pay for all this beer, is what Greg is trying to say.
Buy me a pint, and I will look at you, and I will take a sip, and I will go.
He'll mention you on the podcast. You know what it's like? You know what buying Greg Wyshynski a pint is like? It's like every general manager hates this. When their owner goes golfing with like a set of fans, the general manager always gets a call that afternoon after the owner has a couple of drinks and has to do what? Put someone's kid on the Zamboni. Every GM, he's going golfing with fans. That means we got to stick another kid on the Zamboni.
Right, or the owner.
Yep.
That's what happened in Florida, right?
They just take over the entire franchise. Oh, you want to be GM? What qualification? Oh, you can spell general manager? You're in. It's your job. Have fun. Play trades. You played fantasy hockey as a kid. It's good enough. Hey, what's going on?
Hey, everybody. Hey, we'll see you tomorrow, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks to Mike Hyka. Thanks to Dan Murphy. And thanks to you, the listeners, for once again supporting this podcast. If you have it in your heart, go to iTunes and leave us some love. We always appreciate it. Thanks, everybody, for listening, and we'll see you tomorrow. Bye. Thank you.